Welcome to Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting at 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. And here in our Atlanta studio, we have Greg Bluestein, the political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, one of the political reporters, and Dr. Andra Gillespie, who is an associate professor of political science at Emory. It's great to have you back. It's been a while since we've seen you, Andra.
Thank you for having me.
Have you been having a good summer?
I have. It was a short summer.
Yeah, oh, believe me, I get that. And we're very happy that Charles Richardson, the editorial page editor and a columnist for the Macon Telegraph, is in our studio in Macon. Charles, it's really a pleasure to have you join us for what I hope is just the first of a number of appearances on this show. Thanks for being with us, Charles.
It's a pleasure being with you.
So let's get right to it. Greg, every single time I get set to do one of these shows, I think, let's not start with Donald Trump. And what ends up happening?
We start with Donald Trump.
We start with Donald Trump. And of course, today we really have to, because overnight his campaign made a surprise announcement. They said that ahead of this much anticipated speech, in which Trump is expected to lay out his immigration plan once and for all in Arizona, he was making a quick trip down to Mexico City to meet with the president of Mexico. Yes?
Yes, this has got to be one of the most important days of the Trump campaign. This immigration speech tonight was supposed to be a blockbuster anyway, and now he's meeting with the man he once compared to Mussolini, to Hitler. He once vilified. He's vilified Mexicans, as we heard earlier, some Mexicans as rapists and criminals. And now he's going to have a brief meeting with Mexico's president to talk about his controversial proposals.
Well, I want to be careful here, because was it not the president who called Trump a Mussolini-like figure?
There's been a war of words.
Right. There. Okay. Yeah. I just want to make sure that our listeners understood what you meant. All right. So let's really get engaged on this. Charles, let me come to you on this first. What are you thinking about this trip, this last-minute hurried trip?
I just don't see how this is going to do him any, how this is going to turn out well for him. There are a couple of things that I think of right away. One, language. Peña Nieto can speak English. As far as I know, Trump isn't fluent in Spanish. There is bound to be some miscommunication. When you throw something like this very quickly together, you've got security issues, you've got language issues, you've already got two people that, quite frankly, probably don't like each other. Peña Nieto is got low approval ratings already. So what is Trump doing? What does he want to get out of this? Later on this evening in Phoenix, he will probably moderate his immigration stance. I can't see anything else he can do.
Yeah. So, Andra, let's pick up on what Charles suggests here. He makes a very good point. Mm-hmm. Both Pinedo and Trump have very, very high unfavorables. So presumably they might do each other a little bit of good. But Mexico City, I mean, this is a very unpredictable place. And there could be demonstrations in the street, people turning out who oppose him. And here's the question. Is the Trump campaign hope that there is that sort of response, because they can use it to their advantage here in the United States?
Well, the question that I have about this is, what optic is the Trump campaign attempting to achieve with this visit? And I'm not 100% sure I'm clear about what the optic is. So when you've had other presidential candidates go abroad, they do it to burnish their foreign policy credentials. They usually make a big address in front of a crowd someplace in order to make themselves look presidential. About the only thing that can look presidential from this event is the photo opportunity that will come afterwards, because it's a private closed-door event. So in that respect, it looks a little bit different. And I'm not 100% sure what the value added is. You know, people have been talking about Trump's position and the stake that he's claimed as a negotiator, but he's not empowered to make any negotiations or to make any deals on behalf of the U.S. as a presidential candidate. So there isn't any kind of deal really that he can try to garner. So will he do this back deal? Like, I know I'm saying all this stuff now, but like, I promise once I get reelected, things will be a little bit different. And it's a question we won't really know that. And I'm not sure that he would show his hand. And then it becomes a question of, can he control Enrique Peña Nieto? And I am not 100% sure that he could control that, because if some type of, you know, quid pro quo, a conversation were to happen behind closed doors, given Peña Nieto's unpopularity, he's likely to run his mouth and say that this is what Trump tried to offer me, and that could be a headache for Trump.
You know, okay, so we are only speculating, Greg, but, you know, this feels like the sort of thing that Kellyanne Conway, his new campaign manager, who's trying so hard to make him, to remold him as a true presidential, a figure who can be presidential. Seems like the sort of thing she would come up with. But again, it's as Andra points out, this is so last minute. Mm-hmm. There is no speech that we know of in Mexico. This isn't, you know, Obama going overseas and giving a major speech on how he sees the world in his terms. So it does feel like a stunt in some ways.
It's a high-stakes visit with very little planning, as Andra mentioned. A lot of these visits have weeks and weeks of planning and preparation. And you're right, and he's going to be there for about a few hours. He's supposed to land in a couple hours, and he's supposed to jet out right before his 8 p.m. our time speech in Arizona. And what little word we know from the Trump campaign that they've said about what to expect was that that Mr. Trump will focus on the positive, seeing it as the start of some sort of dialogue, and he'll only briefly mention the wall, which is hard to figure because you're expecting President Nieto to focus pretty much his entire conversation on the wall, which is very unpopular.
Yeah, we should point out, Charles, that this is a private conversation. There will not be media in the conversation. At least that's the way this has been planned, which means that the only people's words we'll have for what happened in that room are Donald Trump and his campaign people and Pinedo himself. So we might have very different versions of what happened in that meeting, Charles.
No doubt about it. But you're going into the jaws of the dragon, and you can be sure that Peña Nieto will have something in that office or that room that will record this conversation. Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Knowing who you're dealing with,
yeah.
that they will be able to verify what you'll be able to say. Now, whether that is released or not, who knows? But if there is a difference of opinion after this, I bet you a transcript will be readily available.
Okay, so let's, as long as you've got the floor for a minute here, Charles, let's establish for the conversation that we move forward with a little bit of a baseline about Macon right now, if we can. Give me a sense of how your fellow Maconians are thinking about this presidential race right now. Is Macon fairly red at this point, or in fact, is it purple?
Well, let me tell you, they're called Maconites, by the way, for some weird reason. But there's a reason that Pence went to Houston County and not into Macon-Bibb County.
Sure, because it's largely a much whiter community than the city
it is,
of Macon.
They traditionally vote Republican. Macon-Bibb County traditionally votes Democrat. So he was at the Houston County, the Georgia National Fairgrounds. And the room that he was in, he drew about 400 people, which would normally be a pretty good amount. But in this particular venue, it's really more like a large horse barn than anything else. And 400 people is like a drop in the bucket in this place. But it's predominantly white. Very Republican. Democrat doesn't really stand a chance running in Houston County. So, of course, he's going to have a base of support there. In Bibb County, where Macon is located, Macon-Bibb County, consolidated, he would get the outlying counties to come in, but Trump's support inside Macon-Bibb County would be lot less.
Understandably lower. And thank you for clarifying, because I get that. I obviously do get that. All right.
We're only 12 miles apart. So
all that said, and all of you are welcome to weigh in on this, not just down there in your neck of the woods, Charles, but around the state, If Trump, in fact, moderates his position, Andrew, let me start with you. If he comes tonight and says, well, you know, we'll send the worst of the criminal element back, but we've got to find some way to be humane, isn't he putting himself in a really awkward position? And how do you think Georgia voters are going to respond?
So I think the fear on both sides is, do the people in the center who haven't supported him up to this point then give him a second look? And then do the people who are more on the extremes abandon him because now it looks like he's compromising? And that's always the fear of the pivot that has to happen during a general election season, that you end up losing people on the fringes. But realistically speaking, if you haven't already decided to join the Gary Johnson bandwagon and you don't agree with all of the elements of what the libertarians are offering, those far-right Trump supporters probably don't have any place to go. And so long as they get part of, you know, what they were promised, and probably the wall is probably what they care about the most, they may be okay with the pivot. I think the question is, does the pivot appear to be credible to those who are on the fence, to those who are ideologically in the center, who have been afraid to support Donald Trump or have been turned off by his rhetoric so far? And so I think that the fear there is worse, that this is too little too late for
them. Yeah, Greg, you were on the road with Mike Pence throughout his visit here, and you, in fact, wrote about how the what people in the crowds were saying to him about immigration.
Yeah, I went to all three of his stops in Perry, in Marietta, Cobb County, and in Dalton, and interviewed about 24 people at each of the stops overall. And same thing, I think that most of his supporters saw any backing off the wall or deportation plan as a betrayal, but still would support him. But many of them had very, very harsh things to say. They said, one person I quoted said, I want them to round up all the illegals and kick them out, and there's no two ways about it. That's what he promised, and that's what he should live up to. So these are people that still see him as a home, but see it as a betrayal if he backs off.
Yeah, but I also saw a quote from someone else you interviewed who said, well, I don't want him to change on this, but basically he's my guy. I mean, I assume that's more in keeping with what Andrew's saying.
Yeah, others, there's one person I quoted who said that they never really thought that he would be able to deport 11 million people living here either way. So there's a sort of rationality among some of the voters. They get that he won't live up to all of his promises, but they at least want him to make a try of it.
All right. Charles, you have, and again, your broader community down there, an awful lot of people in agriculture, and even those who are hardcore Republicans and probably supporting Trump, the notion of trying to get rid of undocumented workers who are so necessary at harvest time is a pretty difficult one for them to swallow, isn't it?
Oh, it's very difficult. If you remember back in the 90s, there was a period of time, I believe Saxby Chambliss was still in the House of Representatives at the time, and they did a raid in the southern portion of his district. And they did the raid, and all of a sudden, all the undocumented folks disappeared. He was given a message very clearly, very quickly, that this wasn't acceptable. Not only does it hurt the farmers in that area and would continue to do so, but also the economy of that area all of a sudden hit the bricks because those folks spend money. They make money in the fields, they pick the crops in the fields, and they also spend that money that they make in the stores and businesses in that area. So I would imagine that while the people that are supporting Trump right now and want you to kick them all out, they may be careful for what they ask for.
All of which says that everything we're saying here shows us how complicated it mm-hmm. is to think about how you find a position that really works for the broadest segment of voters out there, Andra.
And so, I mean, I think that this is the problem of Trump's candidacy, and this is going to be harder as this election cycle goes on. Trump has really garnered a lot of support and attracted a lot of people to him by making a lot of very simplistic promises. And now he's got to provide details about how he would actually execute those promises. And I think the question becomes, one, does he demonstrate an understanding of the issues to be able to, you know, give people the assurances that he could actually do this job? And then are people satisfied with the details actually once they hear it? I think that's a big question for the next 2.5 months.
Yeah. And a side note to that, the wall, the deportation, that wasn't just sort of an amendment or a side note to the campaign. That was the centerpiece of his campaign. It was the driving force for so many of his supporters to back him in the primaries. And so this isn't just something that they could, you know, they see him, it's okay to bend on this and move on. This was the determining factor for a lot of his primary supporters. That's why this isn't just like some other campaign flip-flop you could see
okay,
in other years.
But all right, and I open this up certainly to anybody who wants to answer this. But here's what I find really fascinating as this discussion is unfolding this week on cable news shows. Trump now, I heard Kellyanne Conway on a number of shows say that, among other, that what Trump really wants to do is enforce the law, that there's federal agencies like ICE out there that are ready to do their job, but they've been hamstrung. And now Trump is saying he's going to do it. Well, the reality is President Obama has expelled under the federal laws and using ICE and, you know, to expel more undocumented residents than any president before him. So the question is, if Trump is moving to the Obama position, what is he offering that's new?
Well, I mean, he's tapping into frustrations that were already there. So, I mean, if you look at some of the anti-immigration laws in places like Alabama and places like Arizona, what they were saying was that the federal government wasn't doing its job. And so there is this narrative that's already out there.
But it's not true.
But perception is reality.
I understand that. But, Charles, that suggests to me that, and this is not unlike the Obama administration, that over the years, they have not always done the best job, and neither has the Clinton campaign, in telling people what they are actually doing. Now, I assume, Charles, that makes the administration a little uncomfortable to say, what do you mean we're not expelling millions of undocumented? But on the other hand, it happens to be true, doesn't it?
Well, you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you
right.
don't. If you make a public pronouncements of how many people you're putting out of the country, you have a lot of people that you really tick off.
Right.
And from someone that's been stopped along the Arizona border on vacation by the Border Patrol on more than one occasion at the different checkpoints, you know that they're trying to do their job, and they're doing it quite effectively. But you also get a look at the landscape that they have to deal with. There is a border that is thousands of miles long, and there are it's to say that it's porous would be an understatement. But also, you have to look at Congress. Congress, are you going to give whoever is the president the amount of money it's going to take to make that border? And I'm not talking about just a wall, but the people to man that wall. We've been talking about walls in this country since President Bush was president, if that's what you want to do. But you're right. Obama has not trumpeted the fact that he's put out more people than any other president before him. And, you know, I think that's a political move on his part.
Well, yeah, it is a real dilemma for them, too. They have dilemmas as well as Trump on this issue.
Yeah. And you ask what is Trump promising that Obama hasn't as well? Trump is getting into murky territory with his deportation force, too. We're going to hear more about that tonight, exactly what that means and what that would entail. His campaign has said it could be a slow, gradual process, but having a force that goes around and tries to root out one by one, I guess, illegal immigrants or people who are here illegally, that's a new phase for American immigration laws.
All right. Andra Gillespie has offered to keep us up to speed on where the Trump visit to Mexico stands. She's monitoring one of the cable channels right now as we sit here. And Andra, you'll let us know if we suddenly see the big Trump jet.
Will do.
Landing. Let's do this. Let's take our first break of the show. But as we do, let's just listen to some of the things that Donald Trump has to overcome in his visit to Mexico today. This is just a little assortment of things he's said over the past year or so.
The president of Mexico yesterday, or the ex-president, whatever, whoever, who cares? He said, we will not even consider paying for the wall. You ready? Who's going to pay for the wall? Who? You remember when Fidel Castro took over, he opened his prisons and he sent everybody over to the United States in a much, much, much more sophisticated way. Mexico's doing that to us. So I had an idea. I think it's good. Every time Mexico really intelligently sends people over, we charge Mexico $100,000 for every person they send over.
So there's Donald Trump. These are the things that he will talk to the president of Mexico about in the next couple of hours. Should be fascinating. It's almost 2:26 on Wednesday afternoon. We have Charles Richardson in Macon, Greg Bluestein, and Andra Gillespie here in the studios. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way and come back. We have a lot more to talk about, including Greg Bluestein, the question of whether Georgia has been a feint, a decoy by the Clinton campaign to force Trump to spend money here. Fascinating question. We'll be back.
On the next Fresh Air, our week of favorite recent interviews continues with Larry Wilmore. His Comedy Central satirical news show was canceled earlier this month. We'll hear three interviews with him, one from soon after his show premiered last year, one after his 100th episode, and one from this year after hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Join us.
Fresh Air is today at 3 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Charles Richardson, the editorial page editor and a columnist for the Macon Telegraph in our Macon studios. Thank you for being here, Charles, and Dr. Andra Gillespie of Emory University, Greg Bluestein of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We should say Jim Galloway is on vacation in a location we're not allowed to reveal. He'll be back with us next. I don't either. He'll be back with us next Wednesday. Just a couple quick notes. First of all, you can tweet us, as always, at PoliticsGPB. And even if you choose not to weigh in on the issues we're discussing, follow us. It's a great way to keep abreast of what people in the listening audience have to say about politics. Politics GPB. The other quick note I wanted to mention here is, you know, we did our first ever voter panel on last Friday's show. And I cannot tell you how thrilled all of us are by the response that you all gave us about that show. You told us, many of you tweeted us, sent me emails, posted various notices that you really liked it. We thought it was really fun and informative. And so Jenny Ament and Trevor Young and I, our producing team, have said we're going to do this again in late September. And we'll once again give you a chance to let us know why you think you should be on that panel. But thank you so much for your positive response to last week's show. Greg Bluestein, you know, you have a poll that shows the Clinton-Trump race close.
Mm-hmm.
Fox 5 had a poll that showed it close. WSB-TV has a poll that shows it close. And all of a sudden, Georgia is popping up on everybody's maps as a state that is up in the air. And what we've said on this show a couple times is, really, is this not a red state? Yeah.
Yeah, and you've seen some investment following those polls. You've seen Hillary Clinton's campaign has pumped in six figures. We're not sure how close those six figures come to seven figures, but I think it's on the lower scale into the state party here. You've seen an additional staffer being hired. Talk of another additional staffer coming, and really, Republicans remain privately and publicly very confident in where this state will end up. And there's been this worry beneath the surface that that all this is just trying to drum up Republican defense to force Mike Pence and Donald Trump to play defense here.
Pence spent 2 days in this state.
Yeah, that was interesting. He didn't. I expected a quick, you know, night visit, a Monday night, and for him to leave. And he spent two full days here, pretty much. Went to Perry, Georgia, had a cross-section of Republicans. Dalton, which was sort of Tea Party country. Perry, Georgia, meeting with a lot of farmers and evangelicals. And then talk about the Buckhead elite. I mean, his big fundraiser in Buckhead was
Bernie Marcus, yes.
Bernie Marcus, some of
Home
the
Depot
party's,
founder.
Yeah, some of the party's top leaders and top donors. That was quite the cross-section of Republicans.
And now comes, though, Politico. Which, by the way, if you don't read Politico and if you're listening to this show, you're a junkie, let's face it. And if you don't read Politico or subscribe to their daily playbook, you're missing an awful lot of really informative stuff. But Politico today has a piece saying this is all a feint. The Clinton campaign knows Georgia is going to be a red state, but they're forcing Trump to come in and expend resources here in Georgia. Andra, Charles, why don't you each? Andra, let's start with you and then give Charles a chance.
You know, I mean, I still am expecting that Georgia's going to end up voting Republican in November until I'm given other evidence to suggest otherwise. However, the idea that you're playing a conventional candidate and you can play this type of chess game with this candidate, I'm not quite sure that I 100% buy it, in part because a lot of stops that Donald Trump has made really have defied logic in terms of, you know, campaigning in places or claiming that he's going to win California or New York. You know, just the numbers don't add up. So to say that Clinton is forcing his hand into traditional states that are unwinnable for him or that are definitely winnable for him, I'm not quite sure that the Trump campaign is actually playing the same game that they're playing.
Interesting.
And then the other part of it that is also going to cause me to cast doubt on this was that DuBose Porter openly bragged at the Democratic National Convention that the DPG was making the pitch to the Democratic Party that they needed to invest in the state. So he takes credit for the fact that there's a six-figure investment in Georgia. Even if it doesn't, you know, pan out this time around, they're trying to lay the groundwork for the Democratic Party to take the Georgia Democratic Party seriously.
Charles, you've been around a long time. You've watched this state vote in presidential elections for years. What do you think? Is Georgia really in play this election cycle?
I don't think it's in play this election cycle, but I will somewhat agree with Audra that what they're doing is setting up not for this election, but we have a gubernatorial race coming up in 2018. And I think that Kasim Reed has been yelling to high heavens that you ought to put more money into the state. And I think this is sort of to placate him, placate some other Democrats to say, you've just taken us out of the box. And I think that by 2018, many of the demographics in the state will be looking more purple-like than they are now. And by 2020, then the state may well switch. So I think they're playing the long game, not necessarily the short game.
And so is Stacey Abrams, so is Jason Carter. The worry they have, of course, those are three potential gubernatorial candidates, is that if Hillary Clinton does win presidency, it'll be a lot harder for them in 2018, even with this groundwork, because the Republicans will just campaign against Hillary Clinton. So it'll be sort of become a referendum on Hillary Clinton, which is exactly kind of what the Democrats fear in 2018.
All right. So I don't want to cast aspersions here on the AJC's polling firm, but are we saying the polls are wrong, or are we just saying people are not going to come home until closer to election day?
Remember, too, that was after our poll came out at the beginning of the month, after what probably was the worst week of Trump's campaign, period. That was the fighting with Khizr Khan, the family of the slain Muslim soldier. That was after the cyber hack call for Russia. So that was after a really rough campaign where he was off message and made all these unforced errors. Every day, it seemed, he made three or four more. He's a little bit more on message now. There's the Republicans who are against Trump probably won't be coming back to the fold anytime soon, but there's a lot of sort of undecided voters that might be coming back to the Republican fold since then, as long as he kind of stays on message, which he's sort of been able to do.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, there are always larger questions of whether or not we properly identify likely voters and sort of whether or not our sampling is okay. But, I mean, I think the function of this is that there hasn't been a poll in this state for 2 weeks almost at this point, and people change their minds. And so what we should expect is volatility between now and then. And also, given the fact that the national polls have tightened up, I would expect that if we were to poll today here in Georgia, it would look a little bit different.
Yeah, in a couple of minutes, I want to talk about the latest problems Hillary Clinton is facing and how they're driving up her negatives. But before we get to that, and are still on Trump, Charles, I'd love to give you the floor for a moment here. You wrote a piece the other day in The Telegraph, your column, talking about what you called a very courageous action by Representative Alan Peake from down your way. We've talked briefly about it on the show. Alan Peake, one of the only Georgia Republicans in leadership who's come forward and said, I don't see how I can support Donald Trump. And you wrote about it. Share with us some of your thoughts on Alan Peake taking that stand.
Well, I mean, Alan Peake has basically said that Trump has the capability of destroying the Republican Party, that he is pushing away groups that the Republican Party and any party is going to need, primarily Hispanics and African Americans. And quite frankly, Trump has done a pretty good job of driving those groups away. The big tent has gotten very much, much smaller under with Trump's rhetoric. And so Alan Peake, being from a community that and from a business that is very diverse. I think he looks toward the future and says, what's going to become of the Republican Party if we don't expand it? I think that he's saying in a few years, we are going to self-implode. We're going to eat ourselves alive. And that's basically what he said. And he had the courage enough to come out and say it. Some would say politically that was not a good idea because he could have just kept his mouth shut. It's not his race. He could have just gone along to get along, but he didn't. And talking to Alan, he said he's gotten a lot of positive comments from that, but he's also gotten some other comments as well.
I'll bet.
That, you know, when Eric Erickson first came out and said what he said about Trump, he actually had to have some people guard his home. Eric Erickson lives here in Macon.
Right.
He actually had to have some protection. And Alan Peake was thinking he might have to do the same thing.
But this is telling, too. Even though Peake said that, and he said that, you know, he worried the party would be going into extinction if it followed Trump policies, he still said he'd be willing to support Trump.
Right.
In November, which is just telling, it shows you how divided the electorate is, yet they're still, and Republicans, the overwhelming fears and concerns over Hillary Clinton overwhelm everything else. And, you know, to Peake, it's the Supreme Court that's the number one issue to him. And he knows that in the next president will have might have a few Supreme Court justices to nominate. And that to him overrides everything else.
Well, we should point out, just put a period on this particular subject, that there was no rush by other Georgia Republican leaders to get behind Alan Peake this subject. And all of the Republican leadership, as you pointed out, they were there for Mike Pence.
Yeah, to varying levels. I mean, you've had some enthusiastic endorsers. You've had some, I will support the party ticket, or I will support our nominee. But yeah, no matter what, you've had the entire Georgia GOP establishment line up behind Pence and Trump.
Okay, go ahead, Charles.
What I wonder is that those Georgia Republicans that are lining up behind Trump in 2018 or when they have to run again, and if Trump is not successful, will that support hang around them like an anchor?
That's a million-dollar
question. Yeah. And that's why you have those varying. You have David Perdue, who puts on the red hat and the Make America Great Again hat, and that picture, you know, Democrats are hoarding for when they might have to run against him in a few years, depending on what he runs for.
Yeah, well, Ted Cruz has got his bet on the other side of this equation, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and there's this fight now on I think in the Never Trump side. I don't think that they've all coalesced. And so I think you have your more multicultural Republicans who are watching in horror nationally and then trying to figure out what their next play is. And then you have your people who are your constitutionalists, like Cruz, who can't get along with Trump. And I still don't know yet which one of them gets more leverage in the event of a Trump defeat as a result of this.
Well, watch that. That's fascinating. All right. Before we move on to Hillary Clinton, there were primary elections, some important ones yesterday. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Bernie Sanders. This is the only race since he lost his bid for the White House that he's gotten personally involved with. He supported her opponent, and she won pretty handily. We all remember the backstory on that. Wasserman Schultz was caught appearing to rig the election, to use a Trumpian phrase, toward Hillary Clinton or her people at the DNC. But she won pretty handily, right?
Yeah, you saw overall in the primaries last night a rejection of the extremes of both parties.
Yeah,
McCain wins. Rubio wins. Wasserman Schultz wins.
So thank you for leading me into what I wanted to talk about. Rubio does win. Charles, Rubio wins. He gets to run against a pretty strong Democratic member of Congress for a seat that he's made it clear over the last couple of years he doesn't really much like having.
Apparently not.
But it is a path to going back to running for president in 2020. But let's talk McCain for a minute. Everybody wondered if McCain has remained in the Trump camp despite some of the harsh things that Trump has said about him.
And everybody's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing, Charles. And everybody's wondered, after he wins his primary, assuming that he does, and he won it handily, does he have to stay with Trump for what could be a tough general election campaign, or does he move away from him? And we got a little bit of an answer that I'd like to play for you all and then have you comment on. Here are just some of the remarks McCain said during his victory speech last night.
And we must be able to resist from a position of strength ideas coming from the next White House, whoever occupies it, that would take the country in the wrong track. It's imperative Republicans maintain our majorities in Congress. It's important to America's future that we have a say over the next president's appointments to this United States Supreme Court.
Really interesting, I thought, Andre. I'm not saying who I think ought to be president, but we have a big role to play no matter what.
So what I'm hearing through in McCain's comments is that he's not going to repudiate Donald Trump because he might lose some votes as a result of it. And we'll see if he steps away, if this really does start to look like a bloodbath and it ends up hurting him down ticket. That will probably be how he backs out of that. But I think what he is saying is he is expressing some concerns about Donald Trump and his grasp of constitutional powers and separation of powers in particular. And he's saying, even if Trump gets to be president, I still have to be a thorn in your side because as a representative in the legislative branch, I have to check executive power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds like a fairly reasonable place for some of these Republican incumbents who are worried about their fall election campaigns to come down. Yes, Greg?
Yeah, and you're seeing a lot of Whit Ayers, a Republican pollster, wrote about this in the Washington Post. Republicans are now taking the strategy that Southern Democrats took for decades back when Democratic presidents were very unpopular in the South, but Democrats were still winning congressional seats. The arm's length approach and the local, and I will be the hedge. I can be the hedge against, you know, whatever administration is in power. And you're starting to see that here, and it'll be interesting to see if Donald Trump's numbers don't really improve, to see whether or not Johnny Isaacson and other candidates in the South do the same thing.
Charles, it strikes me that the problem with that strategy, or at least the potential problem, is you may say that in a speech, but when one reporter after another at every event you go to starts saying, do you support Trump? Should he be the next president? There are going to be sound bites out. There's going to be video that your opponent can use against you in a commercial as you try to hedge your bets, right?
And Ann Kirkpatrick is already doing that.
Yeah.
And she's got enough money that she can do it consistently. And again, Trump can be that albatross that she can hang around his neck. And particularly when people ask the question, Mr. McCain, why are you continuing to support this guy that has talked about you this way? You start to look like a fool. And I think when he sees his numbers start to tank, or if Trump says something else that really is kind of off the wall, I think he's going to be forced into saying, look, I can't take it anymore. And a politician's first rule of thumb is to get reelected. So he's going to have to make that decision.
Tell you what, let's take our final break of the show. And when we come back, let's talk about the New York Times. In an editorial yesterday, the New York Times joined a growing chorus of news organizations saying it is time that the Clinton Foundation stop accepting gifts from foreign entities and foundations. And it really raises new questions about Hillary Clinton and her entanglements with the foundation, and raises again people's doubts about her. So it's 2:44 Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you from Atlanta with Charles down there. Thank goodness Richardson in Macon. We'll be back in just a minute.
I'm Robert Krulwich from Radiolab. We're told that smell triggers memory. So if you're in your car, you roll up your windows and inhale. What do you remember? Like the smell of a favorite dog jumping in the back seat long ago? A diaper moment, perhaps. There are some memories you cherish and others that just linger. How about contributing this barrel of aroma to your favorite public radio station? And you might even get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're joined in Macon by Charles Richardson of the Macon Telegraph, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Andra Gillespie from Emory University. Thought crime tweets at PoliticsGPB. I pity us if we consider this election cycle for the presidency as hostile and dirty as 1828 or Cleveland versus Blaine in 1884. Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to go to Google on those, Andra.
Bill, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Charles, I think I could say the same thing about you. I think we've both been around
probably
for way too long.
No doubt.
So let's talk a little about the latest with Hillary Clinton. Her negatives are back way, way up in the latest polling. They come down a little after the Philadelphia convention because everybody, Democrat and Republican, agrees Democrats put on a great show in Philadelphia. But they're back up. And certainly they're back up because there are, again, more new revelations about email, 15,000 new emails that state has uncovered that are going to be turned over for public scrutiny. And then the Clinton Foundation continues to be a we were talking about anchors around people's neck. Holy cow, Greg.
Yeah, there's been report after report about possible overlap between the Clinton Foundation and State Department business, about the nature of their foreign and corporate donations, about their work in pharmaceutical companies, that it continues to bog down, to continue to be an issue for the Clinton campaign. And she's repeated over and over again that they would have that Bill Clinton would have no role, or even Chelsea Clinton on the board of the foundation. But that has not appeased any of the critics or any of the concerns.
The New York Times editorial yesterday, following a number of others, said that it was time to sever ties, and not if she becomes president, as the Clinton campaign has said, but now. The final paragraph of that editorial is: the Clinton Foundation has become a symbol of the Clintons' laudable ambitions, but also of their tangled alliances and operational opacity. If Mrs. Clinton wins, it could prove a target for her political adversaries. Achieving true distance from the foundation is not only necessary to ensure its effectiveness, it is an ethical imperative for Mrs. Clinton. But here's the dilemma, Andra, and I know you already know, but give me that chance to be the host and ask. It seems to make sense that right now she should give that speech, right? Say whatever that speech is. Yes, I messed up on emails. And the foundation, I get there are problems that we have to address, or the appearance of problems. But can she really do that? What ammunition does that give the Trump campaign and her adversaries to use to attack her? It's a very, I think, a tough problem for her. What do you think?
Well, I think this is a situation where she should have done it a long time ago, and maybe she blanches the wound by dealing with it now. And yeah, she's going to take a hit for it, but once she makes that decision, at least that's a demonstration of having learned from her mistakes. I think the problem with this is, one, it's not like this is the first time that the Clintons have been embroiled in a scandal or any sort of hint of impropriety. And so because we can go back 25, 30 years and find lots of things like Whitewater where it looks a little sketchy, or, you know, even them turning $1,000 into $100,000. And, you know, I wish I could do that. You know, types of things, then you know, they've got to figure out a way to do that now. And I think the thing that a lot of people probably are having a hard time with, the same way that you have a hard time for Donald Trump to start making credible claims to minority communities after having talked a year of smack for the, you know, of you know, in all kinds of really grotesque ways, people are going to have a really hard time looking at Hillary Clinton, who seems to me to be the epitome of ambition, not have the foresight to be able to think through that this was going to be a problem in the future.
How
and
did that, they miss that?
I mean, that, like, you know, it's a bad test of character. It's a bad demonstration of leadership.
Charles, Andra just said to me one of the biggest mysteries of this election. How could smart people like the Clinton campaign team miss all this?
Because some people think they're smarter than they actually are. Some people think that they're above it all. They think that because the Clinton Foundation has been doing good works and this and that, that nobody's going to notice the underpinnings might be built on sand, that people won't notice. Well, of all people, the Clintons should understand that when they cross a T wrong, people are going to know it. Mm-hmm. And I whether she comes out now or 2 weeks from now or a month from now, it really doesn't much matter. People have defined her in that way. Those that want to believe that she's crooked are going to believe that she's crooked, and they're going to use it against her whether she comes out now or comes out the day before she's inaugurated, if that's to be the case.
So in some ways, what you're suggesting, I mean, you're suggesting what a lot of us have talked about in this show off and on. Positions, opinions of Trump and Clinton are locked in right now. That's what you're suggesting. All of you.
And for many people, it's pretty hard boiled.
Right. For the okay. So, Greg, here's the corollary to why didn't they anticipate how to deal with this problem of conflicts. The other one was, I mentioned on the show the other day, I don't get how the Clinton Foundation didn't, or the Clinton campaign rather, didn't a long time ago put out an offensive in which they talked about the remarkable work that the Clinton Foundation actually does do. They may not have been willing to come clean when they should have, but we don't really know what the Clinton Foundation does, except we kind of hear a little bit. That's something you would have thought they would have put out there a year ago.
Exactly. There's a blind spot there, and they're trying to put it out now. Bill Clinton was actually here a week ago today, and he was asked exactly about that. Why haven't you separated yourself from the foundation? What do you have to say about these recent reports about the possible overlap with the State Department? And he said, quote, we're trying to do good things. If there's something wrong with creating jobs and saving lives, I don't know what it is. But the problem for him is it's too late to try to change those perceptions. We're 2 months out from the race, and people already associate Clinton Foundation with something, with some sort of wrongdoing.
Yeah. All right. Let's change subject. Andra Gillespie, you're our reporter on the scene, except here in the studio. What's happening with Trump right now?
So I'm watching television. Trump has landed. The problem is that the press pool didn't travel on the same plane with Trump. So they are actually having trouble getting access to the event. So we may not hear a whole lot other than what the Trump campaign produces here, and then if there's anything in the Mexican press that comes over to the U.S.
All right. Thank you for your reporting on that story, Andra Gillespie. You have a future in this business.
Who needs that PhD?
Patty Kosh tweets, if Trump can aggressively capitalize and then prioritize school choice, he can bring minority voters into the GOP. Anybody think that's correct?
Ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. So.
But we love you, Patty.
No. I mean, and I understand what they're trying to say, and I even understand what Alan Peake is trying to say. If you hit on issues that minorities care about, then they'll come over. But you first have to get through the 50 years of a negative reputation that has been cultivated by campaign tactics that have explicitly and implicitly tried to recruit white voters to the Republican Party by scapegoating minorities.
Okay, let's, with a few minutes we have left, pick up on a couple other issues that happen to relate to Georgia. We'll do it kind of quickly. Greg Bluestein, interesting, reports now that in Arizona and Illinois, voting machines were hacked, were tampered with, and people are trying to get to the bottom of who did this and what damage they caused. Meanwhile, the federal government has said, we'll step in and offer assistance to states that are worried about the security of their own voting apparatus. And Brian Kemp the other day, in what I thought was kind of an odd sort of shrug, we don't need the feds. The media and the Obama administration are blowing this out of proportion. This, by a guy who's in the party where Donald Trump is talking about the rigged election.
Rigged elections. And that shows the divide there, too. Brian Kemp basically said thanks, but no thanks to the feds, and said he accused them of overhyping this problem. And you've also got other Republicans, David Perdue, Doug Collins, just in the last few days, too, who have said a lot of this talk about rigged elections and hacking were overhyped and were overplayed. They're saying they're even warning Donald Trump, don't get into this sort of exoskeleton. Don't get down to the guts of our American democracy. You guys can talk about the big debates, but don't start questioning the integrity of our elections.
Wouldn't you think that the Secretary of State of Georgia, and look, we'll get Brian to talk with us about this, but just on the surface, the way he responded to the AJC's inquiries about this, I mean, I'm worried about whether our voting machines can be hacked. Go ahead, Andra, and then you, Charles.
Sorry. Yeah. So I think kind of going into it, there is the Donald Trump framing of rigging that is problematic, especially if this election turns out to be a landslide one way or the other. So you can doubt that rigging will have anything to do with it then. And so you don't want to undermine trust in the system that way, which is probably what Secretary Kemp is trying to do.
Oh, okay.
But then again, on the other hand, there are these other longstanding issues about moving to electronic voting and actually being able to verify votes. And so, you know, paper, you know, ballots or, you know, paper receipts to verify votes and other types of things. And those have sometimes been partisan debates. And those are the debates that we never really resolve.
Charles?
Well, the voting machines at the precincts can't be hacked because they're not networked. They're not hardwired together. They're not wirelessly networked. But once those results go to the various board of elections, all bets are off.
Thank you.
What was that list of all the voters that got released unexpectedly?
Yeah, the Secretary of State.
Into the parties, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that was a whole different thing. That was something internal. But you never know what's going to happen. But as far as the precinct voting machines, you don't have to worry about that. But once it gets into those board of elections, you got another problem.
Are the votes not transmitted electronically by computer from the precincts, from the boxes to the Secretary of State?
Not in Nathan Bibb County.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you're right. Well, thank you, Charles. We have to look at that a little more carefully. That's pretty interesting. All right. We got almost no time left. Greg Bluestein, I'm going to really put you on the spot. And I'm going to do it because your newspaper has reported this. We don't talk rumors very often, but there's an awful lot of talk that Sam Olens is about to go become the president of Kennesaw State University, mm-hmm. and to do that will step down as the state's attorney general. Why were you guys sure enough to put that in the paper?
Well, we noted it's still just speculation, but there's so much talk that sometimes when you're getting calls from Republicans and Democrats who are trusted sources who are saying this seems like it's close to be a done deal, and when people in high places are not sort of dismissing it offhand, there's enough smoke to be maybe fire there. Still not a done deal, still nothing close to being announced yet. But there's already people jockeying to be his replacement, sort of already working behind the scenes.
So I assume Josh McCoon would be one of them, right? I mean, he's expressed an awful lot of interest in that job.
One source told me Governor Deal would be more likely to appoint Barack Obama than Josh McCoon.
That I get. That doesn't mean he wouldn't like it. I will say that I tried to get Olens on the record about this, and his response is, why do you always ask me questions I can't answer?
But so, see, there's no dismissal.
Right.
He didn't say no. And that actually is very telling right there.
There was a straw poll pretty early, but a straw poll about the 2018 race up in Forsyth County.
I think it was Barrow County.
It was Barrow. And Brian Kemp came out way on top. Of course, that's his territory.
With 20 votes, I think the second place got 11. So we've got a real nail biter here.
Charles, it is never too early to start talking about the next election after the one that's coming up.
No, it's never too early.
All right. We're out of time for this edition of Political Rewind. Charles Richardson down in the Macon Bureau, thank you. It's a real pleasure. You have to come back and be on this show.
Had a great time.
Good. That's good to hear. Dr. Andra Gillespie, you know we love having you.
I love being here. Thanks.
Our calendar shows your name over and over again in the months ahead. You just have to confirm.
Okay.
And Greg Bluestein, always a pleasure to have you
Thanks for having me as well.
Tweet us at PoliticsGPB and join our conversation. But more important, like us at PoliticsGP or follow us, whatever you say in Twitter language. We'd love to have you as followers of ours. As we leave you, everybody's talking about Gene Wilder passing away, and Greg's nodding. He was a great, great entertainer. You've heard Pure Imagination more times than you probably need to. So Jenny Ament, our senior producer, thought, why don't we go out with a different Gene Wilder song from Young Frankenstein, Putting on the Ritz. Thank you to Tyler Morris, Jenny, Trevor Young. Our new intern is with us, Robert Jimson. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again Friday at 3:00.